Welcome to Beyond Politics. I'm your host, Paul Hodes, with my co-host, Matt Robeson. We're broadcast on WKXL AM and FM in Concord and coming soon to Manchester, New Hampshire, where podcast wherever you find your podcasts. And if you're listening on podcast, please subscribe to the podcast, like us, tell your friends, and share on social media. We're really delighted today to welcome a special guest, my friend, Congressman John Yarmuth. He and I came into Congress together, but he's still there. And he's the only Democrat in Kentucky's congressional delegation since 2013. He announced last Tuesday that he'd retire after this term. Now, anyone who knows Congress knows what a big, big deal this is. John has served as chairman of the House Budget Committee since 2019. He's been recognized for his work to improve education, expand access to affordable health care, and recently for his leadership in enacting the American Rescue Plan, landmark legislation to defeat the pandemic and rebuild our economy. So, folks, those of you who are listening, take note, it's not many people in life who get to be one of the key architects of a $1.9 trillion bill, and not just any bill, a bill that is lifting 5 million American children out of poverty, saving millions from losing their homes, and saving lives every day by getting people vaccines. John was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. He graduated from Yale University. He was in the newspaper business for a long time. He and his wife, Kathy, have one son, Aaron. John and Aaron and I took a trip, as I recall, together to Israel. That was an important trip for me, and we had a great time. He's got a daughter-in-law, Sarah, a grandson, J.D., and John, very importantly, now all the other accolades aside, folks, John was chair of the Bourbon Caucus. And that perhaps was the most important and one of the most beloved caucuses, of which I was a fond member. Meetings of the Bourbon Caucus were held in John's office, where the display of Kentucky bourbon was unlike anything else in the known world. So, John, really happy to have you joining us on Beyond Politics.
Oh, thanks, Paul. It's great to be with you. It's great to hear your voice. And, you know, I think back to those early days where we came in to Congress having reclaimed the majority for Democrats, and we were known as the majority maker, our first class president. And, you know, it's been an interesting journey for sure.
Oh man, things have changed over the past 10 years since I chose to try to run for the Senate, gave up my seat, but you've stayed. And John, I mean, it's not amazing to me, because your expertise and your ability to think and lead was so evident when we came in together, and you've been chairman of this extraordinary effort in terms of the current budget battles, which are ongoing as we speak. Clearly, what's going on now about the budget, the reconciliation, what size the Build Back Better program will take are in everybody's mind. But I guess my question is, given the important position you now have and the skill with which you've maneuvered, why are you hanging it up now?
Well, you know, it was a bittersweet decision, but I would say 95% of the reasons is a very simple one. And that is that I'll be 75 years old when my term ends, and whatever time I have left, whether it's 5 years or 25 years, I want to control it, have more control over it anyway. Mm. And you know as well as I do that when you're in Congress, you've lost total control of your time. And, you know, I always said that when I left Congress, if I ever wrote a book about my experience, it would be called House Arrest, because there are all sorts of things that make it very difficult to leave unless you're defeated, obviously. But kind of the cycle of the fundraising and the filing deadlines and all these things, it's very difficult with a two-year cycle. And you have to start thinking, well, where do I want to be? And, you know, in my case, we have January filing deadlines. So once you get elected, you basically have, or you're sworn in for your new term, you basically have a year to decide whether you want to be there 3 years hence. And for somebody in their 30s or 40s, that's generally not a tough decision. But when you're again, going to be in mid 70s, it's a whole different calculation. And I know that when I talked to Jim Clyburn and told him the reasons why, and I said, I feel stupid saying this to you at 81, and you're still around.
Right.
But he certainly understood that, as did the speaker and Steny Hoyer. But that's really, I mean, you know, the thought of possibly serving in the minority in the next Congress is certainly terrifying. But I'm actually more optimistic than most about our chances of keeping the majority. So that really wasn't a factor in my decision. This was really, what do you want to do with the rest of your life?
Yeah. You know, I don't think that most people listening who read headlines and read about members of Congress and read about the work of Congress don't really understand or hear too much about the life of a congressman, and don't appreciate what it's like to be on the continual cycle of trying to do your job and then at the same time, in an ethical and an honest way, run for office, literally at the same time that you're trying to do the job and the pressures that come with it. You know, I mean, I have sometimes joked on this show, I spent my time in Congress in a beige windowless cubicle being handed call sheets by 20 somethings and calling people who used to be my friends for money. And then I'd occasionally get to go back to my committee and do some work, making an appearance on C-SPAN in an empty room or visiting the House floor where I'd finally get to relax with people waiting for votes. So the pressure, if you pay attention and do your job as you have done, the pressures are enormous, and it's not a glamorous life. It's extraordinarily hard work. So I hear you, and I appreciate your sharing with us the real life factors that have gone into your decision.
Right. One other thing, Paul, that I think when, like the first year I was there, people would ask me, as I'm sure they did you, what's been your biggest surprise about the
right.
job?
Yep.
And I would always answer how physically demanding it is.
Correct.
I mean, just here, you know, we don't eat well, we don't sleep well, we're commuting every week back to our districts. When we're in our districts, we're running around like crazy. And, you know, again, losing control, we have no control of our schedule. You're doing 8-9 events a day. And when you're on the Hill, you're constantly walking back and forth. It's,
you know, I have a couple of, I had a couple of pairs of shoes, John. I had a couple of pairs of shoes when I was in Congress, all black, of course. Now I spiced them up with colored shoelaces, but I was going through some stuff recently to try to get rid of old stuff. I found these old shoes. The heels were all worn down on all my shoes because we basically had to walk something like six miles a day back and forth from office to committee to the House. And I mean, it's a physically demanding job.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and actually I'll just put in from a staffer perspective that one of our jobs is, you know, you're constantly being inundated with requests from constituents and advocacy groups and media and everything else. And then there's the leadership in the House who's calling you up and saying, hey, you got to get your boss there for this vote and you've got to do this. And the hours are long. Well, we're not making any of this stuff up. One of the things that would happen with Paul, and Paul's not a wimp. I guarantee you folks, Paul is not a wimp. One of the things that would happen is every few months, he'd just have a physical collapse. He would just suddenly call up and he'd say, I can't go anywhere. I've collapsed. And, you know, we'd send him to the House physician and they'd literally shoot you full of steroids. I'm not making this up. And you'd kind of like Lazarus, like rise from the bed and you know, you'd go and meet with constituents. This is a real thing.
It's a good story, but absent the steroids, they did not shoot me up full of steroids, but I mean,
maybe it was something stronger.
No. But I did frequently come down with stuff, you know, because folks, this is pre-COVID. So luckily you didn't have to worry about COVID. COVID has only added to the health concerns, but I was constantly coming down with colds and flu and other stuff. And you have to work through it all the time. So I'm not whining about the job of being a congressman. I loved my job. I know John loved, it's clear how much, you know, John loved his job. We were, yeah, we're happy to do the work and do the work, but it takes a toll.
Let me actually, I'd love to take us back at Chairman Yarmouth to something you said a few minutes ago. I'm not a literary agent, but I guarantee you, you could sell a book called House Arrest. Just the title is half the battle with these things. And you, that is just a slam dunk of a title. So let's live on this show. I would love to write your book pitch as your not literary agent. The number one thing that I think people would like to hear about, I mean, you are not just inside the room, you are running the meeting when it comes to some of these fraught negotiations inside the Democratic caucus with the biggest piece of legislation. I mean, many people compare it to the legislation that created the Great Society. We're now in the thick of the Build Back Better agenda paired with the infrastructure bill. And collectively, it's the biggest package of legislation that's been passed in the last 50 years. And of course, there have been so many stories emerging in the media about what a difficult back and forth that's been. So as you write the first chapter of your book live on air with us right now, what stood out to you? What's it been like maneuvering inside that room and inside that negotiation? Anything you can share with people about some of that contentious back and forth?
Sure. One of the interesting things has been that, you know, my job in this process pretty much is hurting. I've said my goal throughout all of this, both with the American Rescue Plan and now with Build Back Better, and well, I haven't been really engaged in the infrastructure bill, has been to be not Joe Manchin. In other words, I don't want to be an obstacle getting this done, or not Kyrsten Sinema. So what I've been trying to do is, you know, I've met with all the caucuses, the progressives, the Blue Dogs, the New Dems, the Hispanic caucus, the Black caucus, and try to figure out where their bottom lines are and where their red lines are, if there are any. And one of the things that's actually been pretty revealing to me is that the only people who have been drawing red lines in this process have been the people who have never been in a governing majority before. People like, at least in Congress, they may have been in the state legislature, but so, you know, Pramila Jayapal, this is her third term. Josh Gottheimer, I could go down the list of all of them who have taken pretty strident positions.
Pramila's the leader of the progressives and the leader, I guess, of the moderate faction that have been having the back and forth.
Right. And I think that's telling because they've never been in a situation where they have to accept 80% of a piece of legislation. And they feel they were sent here with a mandate to do something dramatic. And, you know, you never get 100% of what you want in Congress. And so that's, I think, been one of the biggest revelations to me. And they'll learn. I mean, they're learning right now. Yesterday said, you know, we're real happy with what the reports that have been coming out about what is going to end up in the final package. She said, we're real happy because all of our priorities have been addressed in one way or another. And so, you know, that's certainly a sign of her maturing in this process. She's no longer, we're not going to support this bill if it doesn't have $3.5 trillion of top line spending. So that's been something that I think, again, we're just breaking out of. And I really attribute it to Joe Biden coming to the House about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, when he basically said, look, we're not gonna do these separately. We're gonna pass both these bills or I'm not gonna sign them. And so we all need to get on board. And I think that refocused, everybody was out playing their kind of attention games and brinkmanship. And then he put it in perspective and said, no, we're gonna get these done and we're gonna do them as a package. And I think that kind of broke a little bit of the logjam and created a little bit different mindset.
You know, just thinking back to what you said about, you know, let's find 80% of what we want, and remember the perfect is the enemy of the good. You know, I recall when we all had really tough votes to take. I mean, if I could vote on a big bill that had 80% of what I wanted, I mean, that was a red letter day. Most of the time it was the case was 51% and hold my nose and pray that I could, that there was enough good stuff in it that outweighed the bad stuff. And I learned that lesson pretty quickly. John, talk to us a little bit about how things have changed since we came together to Congress. What's the best change? What's the worst?
I'm not sure there is a best change. You know, I think, and this gets way in the weeds, but I would say the way we've actually changed the schedule so that we're spending 2 weeks away from Washington and reserving those weeks for committee work, hearings and markups, and then 2 weeks of voting. So when we're in Washington, we're voting almost exclusively. Committees basically aren't meeting. They've done their work in the 2 weeks. This was pandemic, creation of the pandemic, because for a while, nobody wanted to come to Washington. And the way to get the work done was remotely. Well, the rules have never allowed electronic voting, although we're now doing remote proxy voting. But committee work is fine under the rules. But I think that's been a good change. The worst change has been that we now have one party that has given up all interest in governing. And so we find ourselves constantly, since we've been back in the majority, we're negotiating with ourselves, but we're not negotiating with Republicans because they're not interested in participating. This, you know, the first evidence I saw that was back when we were doing the Affordable Care Act, and I was on the Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah.
And you would think that a bill that was going to affect every American directly, that was going to affect 18% of the American economy, that everybody would want to participate in that process.
Right.
And we had a meeting, I'll never forget it, of the members of the Ways and Means Committee. This is rare. It's almost unheard of. No staff in the room. You know this, Matt. No staff in the room. No, obviously no media. It was just 45 members. And our chairman at the time, Charlie Rangel, asked the Republicans, he put it just this way. Is there any way we can write a healthcare reform bill that any one of you can support? And they said, no. And then they started saying, but we'd like to see this in it and this in it and this in it. Well, Charlie asked, if we put those things in it, would you vote for it? No. And another example more recently is, you know, we had a debate last year about raising the minimum wage. And, you know, a lot of Democrats have been raising the federal minimum wage to $15. Well, what did the Republicans say? They didn't say, no, well, maybe we ought to raise it to 9 and then 10 and then 11. They said, no, we don't want to raise it.
Yeah.
Well, how do you deal with that?
Right. You don't. You can't.
No.
Well, I think we're only laughing along because it's easier to laugh than to cry about something like that. And I mean, I'd love to suggest that if you'd had staff in the room, we would have gotten it done for you, but we wouldn't. It's just as bad on the staff level. You were just starting to say that one of the changes that has occurred since you and Paul came to Congress 15 years ago is that it's just become harder, if not impossible, for Republicans and Democrats to work together because Republicans have taken this approach of saying no to everything. And when you ask them, well, are there things you'd like to see? They say, yeah, we want this, this, and this, but we're still not going to vote for anything you put forward. We're not going to talk to you. We're not going to have a meaningful exchange. There's no partner for peace here. And so it's become sort of a pointless exercise. It even went so far in 2012 for the then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to say that his number one job was to prevent President Obama at the time from getting a second term. He wanted to be the land of no, say no to absolutely everything. Now you share a delegation in Kentucky with Leader McConnell. You actually have insights into him that the rest of us around the country really don't have. So what does the national media and the average political observer not understand about him? Are there things that Democrats can do to work productively with him and Republicans, or is it like Barney Frank once said, you might as well just talk to the coffee table.
I think it's closer to the latter. I've known Mitch, and for those, nobody would know this in this audience, but I was Republican until 1985, and I was a political ally of Mitch's. Now, back then, you could still be a progressive and be comfortable in the Republican Party. Well, not in 85, but certainly in the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, that's, so I've known Mitch since 1968. And Mitch has always been someone who has never really had an interest in policy. That's the thing that people should know, first and foremost. He doesn't care about policy. He cares about power. And he cares about his position and his personal legacy, but he doesn't really care about doing anything with that power. That's the strange thing. It's like he has said his greatest legacy will be packing the federal court system with conservative justices, but he doesn't know to what end. It's not like he thinks, okay, now we're going to have federal justices, so we're going to get this kind of a country. The thought process doesn't go that far. And that's, to me, just a waste of a career. But it's also, it makes it very, very difficult. The current debate, and Mitch will say anything. Mitch is shameless. He will say anything, even if he said something 180 degrees different 5 minutes before. And, you know, I'm in the unfortunate, but somewhat unfortunate position of being the only Democrat in the federal delegation. So I'm always asked to comment on things that Mitch says. And I feel like I'm kind of piling on, but I can't let him get away with a lot of the nonsense that he spews. I think the most important recent example of that is regarding the debt ceiling and Mitch's position that he will say unequivocally, the debt ceiling has to be raised. We cannot default on the debt of the United States, but neither I nor any of the Republicans are going to help the Democrats do it. And it's a purely brazen, blatant political calculation. It has nothing to do with the substance of the question, which is, would members allow the United States to default on its debt for the first time in its history? And he will say, well, this is the Democrats' debt. You know, we don't want to raise the debt ceiling because of the... They're proposing putting up all this legislation. Well, a lot of the debt he voted for, including the CARES Act and many other things that were enacted during the Trump administration. But he's not even accurate about that, because if you look at the tax cuts that Republicans passed without a Democratic vote in either the House or the Senate in 2017, those tax cuts are still adding to the national debt as we speak, about $250 billion this year, about another $250 billion next year, maybe $220 billion the year after that. So he is actually just in denial, saying not willing to admit that this is partially a totally, purely Republican debt that he's not willing to pay for. And I said, you know, that he must have gone to the Trump school of business, which is don't pay the debts that you accrue. But again, he is the most Machiavellian politician, I think, that probably ever walked through the halls of the Capitol.
You know, in addition to being a graduate of the Trump School of Business, he's also clearly a graduate of the Trump School of Integrity in terms of the way he speaks. And that has, I think that's largely eluded the media and the public in holding accountable politicians who simply lie for convenience and for political power. And it's up to the American people to take note and for the media to really call it out. And when the media is covering powerful people, often that just doesn't happen enough. But another thing you talked about in terms of what the Republicans have done and frankly usually do when they're in power, which is dig us deeper and deeper into a hole of debts and deficits. I want to turn to an actual policy discussion, which is that Medicare faces a 30-year shortfall in trillions of dollars, something like $71 trillion, $31 trillion for Social Security, discretionary spending, $3 trillion a shortfall. I mean, in terms of budgeting terms, we're looking at an awful lot of American red ink. And I'm curious to know whether you and fellow Democrats see that as alarming or manageable. I'm a member of the Concord Coalition, which has been crying into the wind about debts and deficits for a long time. Even when I came to Congress as a Democrat, when it wasn't necessarily fashionable, I was worried about debts and deficits back then. So does it make the wrangling over the price tag of the Build Back Better program more frustrating or understandable? Or does it matter at all anymore?
It's interesting, Paul. We had February of 2020, we had a hearing in the Budget Committee called Does Debt Matter? That was the title and the subject. And we had four economists, one of whom was Douglas Holtz-Eakin, who's been a deficit hawk all of his life. And this was, and he was director of CBO, Congressional Budget Office, at one point.
Yeah.
And all four of them basically said, no, right now debt doesn't matter. And part of that was that we had to respond to the pandemic, and we needed to spend whatever we needed to spend. But there was a bigger perspective on this, and that is that for years, we have been thinking about the debt, federal debt, in our own frames of reference, our businesses, our families, our state and local governments. And what I think there's a growing realization of is that the federal government doesn't work that way. The federal government can create as much money as it needs to create to do what it needs to do to serve the American people. The only constraint on our ability to do that is that we can't put more money into the economy than the economy can absorb, because then you get inflation, which hurts everybody. Even the Fed chair, Jay Powell, this is called modern monetary theory. Jay has not embraced that, but he has said on many occasions in the last year or so, we have plenty of fiscal space to do what we need to do. Fiscal space being essentially creating money.
Yep.
So the other thing that, you know, that's kind of led to a rethinking of this is, and I remember Paul Ryan was chairman of the Budget Committee back when we lost the majority in 2010, and he would, every meeting, he would come up and put all these charts up. Here's the way the debt's going. It's going this high, and this is going to crowd out all, we're going to end up spending much more to service that debt, and it's going to crowd out other spending. We're going to get all this inflation, and the dollar's going to be weakened. And as time went on, the national debt has tripled since I've been in Congress. Went from $9 trillion to $28
trillion. Right.
And what's happened? We have historically low interest rates. Until recently, because of the pandemic, we had no real inflation. And the dollar's not weakened at all. The dollar's been fairly strong. So a lot of people have been saying, hey, all this stuff that was supposed to happen when we kept accruing debt has not happened. So maybe we're thinking about it wrong. That's kind of where we are today. And again, it's a tough thing to talk about in the public arena, because it's pretty high level thinking, and it's also counterintuitive to the way the vast majority of Americans think about debt, and that's understandable. But the federal government is in a unique position, not just with regard to its ability to spend money, but it's unique in the world. I mean, there are only about 10 countries which have a sovereign currency, which we have, and who borrow and spend in their own currency. And unless you do that, then none of these rules apply. So like none of the European Union countries can do what we can do, because they have a common currency. So it's very interesting. I've become kind of a convert to modern monetary theory, and have had a lot of interesting discussions. And there's a woman named Stephanie Kelton who wrote a book called The Deficit Myth, which has become pretty much a bestseller in the business economics field. And I recommend the book, but all you have to do is go on to YouTube and watch some of her lectures, and you'll get a sense of a very different way to think about how the federal government operates.
You know, the only comment I'd make is that what you have just illuminated has really started setting off sparks in my own in my own head. Matt Robeson and I used to talk about the difference in messaging that between Democrats and Republicans and what Republicans' traditional agenda was about fiscal responsibility and the hypocrisy of coming in to govern and digging us into a deep hole. And then when Democrats take over to fix things, Republicans would always start yelling about the debts and the deficits. And if there was some way to message about this change in thinking and the realization about the unique position that we're in terms of debts and deficits, it would certainly cut one of the legs off the stool of the traditional Republican philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It's a very difficult messaging proposition. And, you know, I get all sorts of flack when I go on media and I talk about this and say, hey, we have the ability to spend whatever we need to spend. And then there are qualifications on that, which, mm-hmm. and you know, when you're explaining, you're losing. And
yeah.
But the other constraints, I shouldn't say the constraint, but the only other thing that's kind of, I think, logical is that you have to spend it in an intelligent way. You know,
sure.
The government can't. So if we just said, we're just going to buy marijuana for everybody in the country, that probably wouldn't be a productive use of more debt. And on the other side of the coin, if you're giving tax cuts to wealthy people who are not going to put that savings to work to benefit the economy, that's also wasteful spending.
Right.
You cut taxes and reduce revenue, and you know companies use it to buy their stock back or to increase dividends to their wealthy stockholders and so forth. So, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, those two examples probably stand on equal footing in terms of the intelligence of the spending.
Exactly.
Well, look, I mean, you really could politically lock down the California vote. I mean, effectively. I mean, look, from the silly to the absolutely profound and perhaps profane, I think that it's beyond question, as we were alluding to a moment ago, that you are going to walk away from Congress having accomplished arguably as much as any individual member of Congress ever with the passage of the American Rescue Plan and what I am confident will be this package of the Build Back Better and infrastructure bill. And those are laudable, historic accomplishments. But I think we'd be remiss to not touch on the other side of the coin, which is what many see and what I certainly see as a looming existential threat to the country, which is, and I'm not talking about climate change in 20 or 30 or 50 years.
Right.
I'm talking about the very real prospect that the 2024 presidential election is going to lead to an absolute meltdown of our constitutional system of government. We came far closer in 2020 than we realized at the time or than most people realize now. And I'm right now, as we record this, in the midst of writing an article that lays out, people are still sleeping on just how deep the threat is just 3 years from now, that it really could be a total, not just meltdown of our system, but an actual violence invoking event. To what extent, now I'm not sure if you agree, but to what extent do you agree? Do you see that danger? And is there discussion going on inside the Democratic caucus about this right now? Because we've gone on the Republican side, not just from voter suppression measures, but to actual election subversion measures passed in Republican-controlled states that would allow Republican legislatures to step in the next presidential vote and monkey with it or actually overturn Democratic votes to deliver the presidency to Donald Trump again in 2024. Is this something that you and your colleagues are talking about and worried about?
The answer is a most resounding yes. I'll tell you, I gave a speech to the Louisville Rotary Club back in 2019. And I started, and I was speaking about something very different to balance my speech, but I just started. I said, by the way, I'm just going to throw this out there. If you don't think that our democracy is in a precarious position now, you're not paying attention. And I just left it there. But clearly, everything that's happened since that time has only made that concern manifold, more significant with the legislation that's being passed in states all over the country. We're very much concerned about it. I mean, that's why we passed H.R. 1. That was the first bill we passed in this Congress to the voting reforms, and then the John Lewis Act, which deals with the Voting Act of whatever that was, 65. And so, yeah, we've done our work in the House, and we talk about it all the time, and we're baffled that in the Senate, there's not one Republican who shares our concern about election integrity. And there's the two Democratic senators who refuse to change the ridiculous to help support our democracy. And obviously that's the filibuster and Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema again. And to be honest, the president has not been as, I think, focused on this and focused on action in the Senate as he should be. But, you know, he's got a lot going, but arguably none of this other stuff matters. You know, if we pass the Build Back Better Act and Republicans take control of the government, then they can reverse that in a heartbeat. So we're all very, very concerned about it.
You know, it's a really tough environment to be facing the rise of autocracy, as evidenced by so much, by what happened January 6th, by the reluctant Republicans to have to wear the mantle of statesmanship to any degree, but rather just to be the party of no to everything. Not you hardly could classify them as a loyal opposition. And at the same time, we have the ongoing issues around the pandemic for the people of the United States. You know, it feels like the 21st century has moved from a shocking disaster on 9/11 through 20 years of increasing chaos and dysfunction, because one of the results of the Republican position, which is we're not going to govern, we don't care, all we care about is power, it has been to brand everybody who serves with the same brush. And that may be the theory, that may be the reason, if we get everybody just so disgusted with politics and what the work of the country is, then we have the opportunity to slide in and take power. Now, we only have a few minutes left, I think, but you know, you and I, John, traveled to Israel together with your son, Aaron. We traveled by bus. We had a remarkable experience together. I remember it well and fondly. And I remember Aaron very, very fondly as a really bright, really bright, just charming and wonderful youngster. Well, now he's a dad, and I have heard rumors that Aaron is reported to be considering running for your seat when you retire, and not necessarily asking you to make any news on his behalf here, but let's just say that he decided to run. What advice would you have for him about running and about serving today as a member of Congress?
Well, I would give him, and by the way, I will make some news. He's not going to run. He thought about it seriously, and I think ultimately he decided there's another candidate who's announced named Morgan McGarvey, who's a Kentucky state senator, a brilliant young guy. And Morgan and my son are very good friends. And he decided that, you know, if Morgan's in the race, he doesn't bring anything different to the race than Morgan does. And I mean, although he's a nicer guy, I think. But and by the way, he turned 38 2 days ago.
Yeah, same age as my son. They're no longer children.
Right, no longer children. But what I would give them, the same advice that I give to everybody who asks me about running: be yourself. Don't try to fake it. Faking it doesn't work. You know, I can give you countless examples going back to Al Gore, and there are many who thought they couldn't be who they are and win a campaign and created false personalities, and they didn't work. Smile a lot. As a matter of fact, smile at every person you meet. That's the other piece of advice I give every candidate. And particularly in this toxic environment, you do use every tool you can to disarm people. And when you smile at them, when you encounter them, that's a little bit disarming. And the other thing is, and this is kind of a corollary of the first thing, be genuine in your beliefs. Say what you believe. People will give you credit for that before they'll give you credit for much else. And the other thing I would say is, in this world, and there are people who will differ with me, but I don't think many anymore. People don't vote based on issues. They don't vote based on what you talk about, the policies you talk about. They vote with their gut. Well, first of all, now they vote with your party label. That's sad, but that's where we are. Your political identity has become part of your personal identity in far too many cases. So I would say that be yourself, make people like you, because that's how they're going to vote, whether they like you or feel good about you. An intuition that you will be respectful of them and that you will listen to them. And that's what most people want.
John Yarmuth, we like you, and we are happy that you're in the position you are, and we wish you well when you retire. I'm blessed to call you my friend, and thank you for joining us. For Beyond Politics, I'm your host, Paul Hodes, with co-host Matt Robeson. John Yarmuth, chair of the Budget Committee, has joined us. What a great conversation from a great friend of democracy. John, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Paul.